This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Reading for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I have the pleasure of visiting with an author who has written a book titled From the Moon with Love, Book 1, Moon Guests. And joining me from somewhere near New York City, actually I think it's in Stamford, Connecticut, is former Ambassador Mitra Vasit. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, thank you very much, G. And hello to everyone who's listening in. I'm Mitra, calling in from Stamford,
yes,
near New York.
Great to talk with you. You have written this book, obviously, by the cover. It's a book that perhaps is designed for a younger audience. Where did the storyline come from? You have mentioned that you have traveled all over the world and must have a very creative mind to create this book. How did this come about?
Oh, I don't know about my creative mind. I was India's diplomat, and we did have chances to work our imagination, but normally we were not imaginative. We followed orders and improvised on the spot. I did get a spurt of imagination from my grandkids and their friends whom I interact with. And I came to the conclusion that the most imaginative community in the whole world is probably kids.
Oh,
they
yeah.
are unfettered and their imagination runs high. That's where I got my inspiration.
Absolutely. You have two main characters. One lives on the moon, I believe, and the other on Earth. Is that a correct descriptive of the two main characters?
Very accurate, Jay. Very accurate.
And how did they become acquainted?
Well, I have my little granddaughter. She's all of 3.5 years old, and she loves stories, and I keep making up stories for her. And the one that she loved best was that she was gazing up at the moon, and I said, yes, she does have a friend up there. And since she loves the moon, I told her stories, and it built up from there. And she did believe that she had a friend over there. And then I thought, children have a way of believing, and if the elders give substance to those beliefs, they end up really making something of their imagination. And so I just let the moon girl come alive. That's what I did.
You've called the character Luna, which is also another term for moon.
That's right. I mean, that was, it's not much of an inspiration. It was an obvious choice of name, but she used to call Luna. She said, "Meets is anything lunar is the girl called Luna." So it came from my granddaughter, actually. My granddaughters, I have two of them. One is Zoe and one is Lida. And Zola is a combination of the two girls.
Actually, because it is a children's book, it's a relatively short book, I think under 40 pages, but there is dialogue in here. It's not just a picture book. How long did it take to put the story to paper and get it ready for publication?
The story bit of it didn't take very long because I had it in my mind. All I had to do was just write it out. What took ages was to get it into the format that was required by the publishers. By the way, I work with a very, very nice set of publishers called Archway, and they guided me. They had a set of regulations and rules and this many lines and this many pages, etc. So fitting it all into that took up more time than actually the story did.
You have two characters primarily, but they're in your story. Are there any conflicts or problems that they need to solve?
Oh, they have a huge problem to solve. The whole story is how there were warriors earlier on, and the Earth and Moon were very friendly. And together they ruled this part of the world, and you know they took their guidance from Brahm. And I haven't called it worshipping Brahm, but that is exactly what it was. And they got their guidance from a book. You know, the book used to appear wherever required, whenever required, gave them instructions. And between the Moon and the Earth, they ran a beautiful world. And the point I was trying to make was that as long as everything was loved and everything was equally loved and cared for in the universe, all that was created by God, humans, animals, plants, etc., and there was harmony around, everything was working beautifully. But then there was one distant planet who did not, and the leader of that, who did not like the supremacy of the moon and the earth, and therein lay the destruction and the conflict. And the book talks about a great war when Dread, he came in with his warrior, spread poison on Earth, and the good Lord, that is not the good Lord, I mean, Brahm, sort of immediately made sure that the path from the moon to the Earth was destroyed so that Dread couldn't reach the moon, because his original plan was to get Earth and Moon together, destroy them, and take over both the planets and rule. He hated the Juno and Cairns, who are the two protagonists, you know. Earth warrior leader is Cairn, and Moon warrior leader is Juno, And Dredd wanted to kill both of them, take over and become the Lord and Master. And the Great War sort of destroyed the Earth, but it kept the Moon alive. And then this story picks up from how Moon is resuscitating these old times. And both Luna and Zola have a very big role to play in the Great Restoration.
Your chapter 3 talks about the Moon Secret and how Zola deals with an all-encompassing problem about her dream. What was the dream that was so challenging for Zola?
Oh, Zola dreamt that her friend Luna, and Zola kept talking to Luna and saying, why don't you come down for my birthday? Why don't you visit me? Why don't you see me? Why don't you respond? And then I go to the moon, and then Zola and Luna knows that the moon people can see the earth people because their powers were not destroyed. But the earth people can no longer see the moon people. And that's why Zola cannot see Luna waving to her every day. And the grandmother feels so bad because Luna says, Zola's crying. Can you please let me go in her dream at least? And Luna comes in her dream and says, Zola, I know you. I hear you. You can't see me. There is a secret. We have to be 6 years old to know the secret. My grandmother wouldn't tell me the secret. And that's where I take it.
Taking it that way. She also has some siblings, some brothers that are a part of the story.
Oh, yes. Anton and Vladan are the siblings of Zola on Earth. And they are both in on the secret because they are over 6 and they got initiated when they were 8. And Luna on the moon also has her 2 siblings. She has a sister and a brother who also know what's going on. And the grandmother knows what's going on. And what is going on is that there is going to be a restoration when Earth will be restored back to its glory. And when the moon and Earth will become partners again, and they'll have to find a way of knowing what happened after the Great War. That is the mystery that comes up in book number 2, which I'm finishing just now.
Oh, phenomenal. You have had this story and been telling it to your, or sharing it with your grandchildren. Are there other children that have been exposed to this? Have you shared this story with other children? What's been the response?
Oh, no. I have been invited to many schools in Stanford and some in New York also, because the book has been circulating for a little while. And the children who have listened to me have found it fascinating when I read it to them. And they ask me the most wonderful questions. And because the whole thing is on a philosophic realm, I've been trying to tell them that the whole story is how one should be equal-minded and keep, you know, the peace and harmony of the earth, which is what God intended, without upsetting it. And when that is the case, then everything is beautiful and everything runs like a lovely current, you know. When that is upset, then things are upset.
What's the most enlightening or exciting or maybe even funny question that children have asked you?
Oh, yeah. Some of the boys asked me, are you going to make it a girl's book? I said, well, obviously not. It's not a girl's book because you have 3 important protagonists over there. One is Luna's brother and 2 are Zola's brothers. Without them, the story cannot move. And the book itself proves that. And some of the girls wanted to tell me, will you please keep the primacy role of the girls, please? You know, that was a 9-year-old girl who said it. So yeah. I said, I think it will unravel that way. But without everybody's contribution, nothing's going to work. So this book is also about how everyone has a part to play in everything, you know, whether it's a play or a charade or a drama or real life. And unless all the parts are played with harmony, the result is less than optimal.
Other grandparents, have they also given you feedback on the story?
Oh, they loved it. The elder, in fact, I think the adults who've read my story have found it very fascinating. Some have tried to draw parallels here and there. And I told them my mind is clear as crystal. No messages are intended. Certainly nothing political. It's just that I value the imagination and the purity of kids. And this book is only about celebrating their imagination and not curbing it, just letting it go.
Well, beautifully done. The illustrations, how long did that take to complete, to get them where you wanted them?
I was asked to give very detailed descriptions of the type of illustrations I wanted, which I did, down to the last detail, including that one of the twins, Zola's brothers, one should have brown eyes, the other should have blue eyes, because there is a story to it that will come out in my number 2 volume. And the illustrators from Archway Publishing were absolutely wonderful. It was a great relationship I shared with them.
Well, it's fascinating that you were able to get this done. A lot of grandparents and even parents have stories they tell their children, but they don't develop into books. So this is a great accomplishment on your part. And also your...
Oh, it was...
Yes, your personal history as an ambassador also is a stunning thing. Is that something that you might weave into a child's story in the future?
That's what my grandson, my grandkids, I have a son and a daughter, and my son has three kids and my daughter has two. So my son's son, the eldest of my grandkids, is Kiran. He's about 7 and a half. And he says, Meets, I want books. And then he loves stories about when I tell them stories about Bangkok, Sri Lanka, Bhutan. Both my kids they grew up in Bhutan for a while when I was posted there. They were both born in Austria. So my grandkids love to hear about how their parents were born in Austria, how they lived in Bhutan, et cetera, et cetera. And my grandson keeps telling, he's all of 7 and a half. He keeps telling me, Meets, when are you going to write that book about being an ambassador? Meets, when are you going to write that book about being an ambassador? So that's the way it goes. I probably end up doing it just for my grandson.
Well, I hope to visit with you when that's completed, too. This particular first edition is From the Moon with Love, Book 1, Moon Guests. And my guest author has been Mitra Vasiste. Thank you for joining me today. Where can they get a copy of this publication?
Oh, they can get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and I must say the electronic copy is reachable. It's very, very eminently, reasonably priced, and that's easy to get too. So I hope they find a way of reading the book and getting some feedback to you, and you can tell me about it.
They will be able to also do a search under your name. Your first name is spelled Mitra, and Vasiste is spelled Vasisht. So they can find you by doing a search, but particularly from the book title, From the Moon with Love. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. This is fascinating, and look forward to visiting with you when book two hits the bookshelf.
And there's only one more point I'd like to say.
Sure.
I have a website, mitravasis.com. They can find details on that also.
All right, and would you spell that out for them, please?
It's MitraVasisht, all in lowercase, .com. It's my name, .com.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mitra, for joining me today and sharing your story. This is a fun book, and parents, grandparents, you should get a copy because this is the season for giving, so you will enjoy reading From the Moon with Love. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Jay.
My pleasure.
Have a good holiday, all of you.
Yes, for Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title of the book, Management Diseases and Disorders, the recipe for dysfunction in the marketplace, I guess would be the way to describe it, 56 Diseases and Disorders. Joining me from California, the authors, Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes, Ph.D. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Hello.
Well, I guess it's a couple of sirs. A couple of sirs, not just a sir. You gentlemen have written a book that is unique in its own right. I'm kind of curious as how it was you gentlemen got together and wrote this. What was the glue that put it together?
Well, Peter and I work for the County of Orange government in California. Peter, I was there 33 years. Peter was there, I think, 17.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so that's how we met. We met when he was the internal auditor for the county, and I was the performance auditor and later became the chief human resources officer. and we had a lot of overlapping things that we did. So kind of at the culmination of our careers there, I was, you know, looking at the internet one day, and I just happened to see a book on medical diseases, and I was kind of skimming through it and having a good time with that. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, I thought, you know what? In management, we have our own diseases and disorders, and they cause sicknesses to people, and they cause sicknesses to the organization.
Right.
And I started kind of the aha moment and started playing with it. And the more I got into it, and the more I started going back and forth between the analogies, I thought, I think we have something here. And with all our experience we've had in auditing in HR, maybe we could flesh this out. So I called Peter and said, hey, what do you think about this? Let's start talking. And when we got into it, we said, we got something here. And
nice.
So it started that way. And then, shoot, a year later, we have a book out there on the market.
And it's actually written in the style of a medical book, is it not?
Yes. We did that very deliberately. We wanted to make it a handy field manual for anybody struggling in an organization. We got 56 diseases and disorders we identified, and we take it very follow that dictionary approach very closely. We have what we describe as a healthy and normal function of a leader or a manager. And then we talk about causes of dysfunction. We talk about risk to the organization of dysfunctional management behavior. We identify signs and symptoms. We give a diagnostic. And then we talk about the progression and impact if not treated. And then we also identify treatments or cures. So for 56 different profiles, if you will, you'll find it easy to read, easy to absorb. And then for every one of the 56, we give a case study that is sort of a composite of our collective experiences.
So those case studies really are, as you say, composites. They're not necessarily a factual recounting of a problem, but it really does mirror things that you have seen in the workplace.
Well, it might be a little bit closer. We took things that we actually saw and experienced, and we tweaked them, changed the names, and made modifications to them. But they are based on things we did observe in various environments. Peter and I have worked in the public sector, private sector, educational sectors, and been successful at all those. And so we had tons of experiences and different things happen. And so it just... That was part of the fun part of the whole thing, is putting those case studies together. And several of our people that we know that have read the book have told us the funnest part they've had is with those case studies. They
all connect with them. It doesn't matter where they worked. You know, they could be in the private sector, public. They can be in the government. They can be in a big or small company. Everybody has those, as Steve says, aha moment where they go, wow, I've worked for somebody like that.
Yes.
And, you know, you asked us about our motivation. My motivation was pretty simple. You know, when I work in a healthy organization where the manager is getting it right, I love coming to work.
Absolutely.
You know, and so do my colleagues.
Yes.
You know, you actually look forward to it. And when you don't have good management, you really have the opposite. There have been, I've worked for managers where I dreaded getting out of bed on a Monday morning and going to work because I just knew that half the battle was going to be working through this manager's dysfunctional behavior.
Right.
So when we wrote it, we said, listen, let's spare our colleagues out there a lot of the grief that we've gone through trying to figure out at the end game to functionality. We had a phrase that we came up with. I don't know if it's original, but for us it was, is let's put the fun back into functionality. And then my wife said, well, you know, you can also put the fun back into dysfunctional behavior if you know the cure.
Absolutely.
And for us, going back to the medical kind of analogy, we've been in workplaces where the bosses have... you know, kind of mild dysfunctional behavior. It's like a common cold. Y'all can work through it. It's not that disruptive. And it has its own shelf life. But we've also worked in organizations where the dysfunctional behavior in the manager is pervasive and persistent and affects literally every decision that that manager makes. And then it becomes contagious in the organization where everyone else starts exhibiting that kind of dysfunctional behavior. And before you know it, you know, you have a dysfunctional group.
Right.
Steve and I were talking before this interview about how we got to the point where we could walk into any organization and within, you know, a short while, we could call whether that was a functional operation or dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instances, we could do it in 30 minutes. Other times, it would take a half a day, but no longer. This book empowers any of the readers to make those quick calls or diagnosis without having to belabor it.
Yes. You have broken it down into two parts, basically. The first part is personality-based diseases and disorder, and then the second part of the book, culture or system-based diseases and disorders, and within those are chapters, subchapters, and obviously the case studies, a total of 250 pages. The the deficiencies or the personality-based diseases and disorders, which of those do you think is the most prevalent in the workplace?
Well, I don't know if you could say something's the most prevalent. We took the personality-based diseases and disorders and further broke them down into personal deficiencies that have to do with an individual's personality, the issues they have with that, and the interpersonal deficiencies with how they relate to other people. Then behavioral deficiencies, which we have three sections on that, which behaviors are based on fear, which behaviors are based on self-interest, and which behaviors are based on having a lack of skill set. So I don't know that one is more important, but certainly some of them are more crucial.
The one I'll say, Steve, I saw most common was what Steve is labeled as the divinity complex.
Right.
Where a person, it's a situation where you get inflated sense of your abilities upon promotion. That's not commensurate with reality, and it can be a kind of a light affliction, or it can be a pretty terminal one, depending upon the individual.
Yeah, and the idea with that was, you know, that when I got promoted to the job, instantly I became smarter, I had more experience, and I was infallible.
Yeah.
You know, just upon promotion.
And what can happen, we saw, is that you could get a, you know, an average person promoted for a variety of reasons, some good, some bad, but they start thinking they're an Einstein, and in the process they also start pushing out all the competent individuals because they make them feel inadequate.
Yes.
So they start surrounding themselves with a lot of less capable individuals who will, you know, fawn over them and assure them that they're, you know, the shopper's tool in the shed when they aren't. And that becomes very dysfunctional in an organization. We've seen it happen. We've seen the capable, competent producers leave that unit or worse, become what we call the working dead. They just get stymied and stifled.
Mm-hmm.
And resign themselves to not being effective anymore. So I'd say that probably the most common experience or common profile we encountered, the divinity complex.
I've seen that in a few churches. I guess that would be okay there. I don't know. The in your book, as you began to write this, did you think that not just management people and HR people, do you think that the regular guy in the cube down the corridor might benefit from being able to identify maybe the leadership that surrounds him?
Yeah, I think that we've got two things that would help the line worker that's got the cubicle down the hall. One is to help you manage your manager. If you figure mm-hmm. out the problems that your manager has and you look in our book and work through it, you can start identifying strategies of how to deal with that. So rather than just sit there and kind of passively accept what happens, you can actually strategize and try to make it work for you. So that's one thing. Second thing is we really want people to look at this just like a medical book in the sense that we all have these. Hell, there's some of these chapters that Peter and I wrote. We go, hey, we've had these before. It's just like a common cold or the flu or a broken arm. Everybody's going to get one of these diseases. The point is, do you admit that you have it?
Yes.
And so we want people to do some self-examination and say, hey, gee, they're talking about me a little bit here. I need to work on that myself. So we hope they can manage their manager and they also can do some self-introspection.
Yes, that's the point, too. It's very empowering. We kind of designed this so that executives could, you know, coach their managers. We call the manager, you know, the managers could self-coach themselves, and then we could have a kind of a how to boss your boss, how to manage your boss in the right direction. If just for instance, I've been in situations where I was overwhelmed with the responsibilities and the complexity of the job. My first reaction was just to kind of avoid conflict, and I kind of discouraged bad news. There was so much of it, I didn't want any more of it.
Right.
Well, that becomes a dysfunctional managerial approach and behavior if it's allowed to continue. Fortunately, I had some pretty seasoned people who saw those symptoms. And they reported to me, but they still were able to coach me out of that situation. So it's, a very empowering book for people who are working for a dysfunctional boss, for a boss who's struggling with the complexity of the organization, and for an executive who is seeing a boss stumbling.
Absolutely. You have a chapter or have a notation of a deer hunter boss or CEO. What does that represent?
That was one of the case studies. The idea was, I think it's not delivering bad news. It was a reference. We had an employee who was at work at a location, and it came to our attention that he had actually shot a deer while he was at work.
Okay.
And so we were like, excuse me? we went out there. It turned out that, yes, it was true that the fella had shot the deer. But you couldn't convince him that he was wrong. He said, well, it was hunting season. I had my license. It was away from the work crew. I had a clean shot, you know. And so you're looking at this going, really? So we finally got to the point where the only thing that he would admit that something was wrong was that, okay, I did it at 4 o'clock and I'm supposed to be working at 4 o'clock rather than hunting.
Wow.
So the problem we had was, we had first talked to the supervisor, and the supervisor was kind of indignant about what had happened. And then we found out from the employee that the supervisor actually drove the guy down to the site where the deer was at, watched him shoot the animal, and then helped him load it into his truck.
Oh, phenomenal. Wow.
Yeah, and so, in fact, as I'm looking it up now, it's the fear of conflict, disease, and disorder. And the idea being when we asked the supervisor, why did you do that? He said, well, I just didn't want to spoil a guy's day. He was having a good time. So I didn't want to be the boss and tell him he couldn't do it.
And that's incredible.
You know, it can be as simple as that. With Steve's experience in HR, where he got the worst cases, the toxic personalities, where there was seemingly no cure, he was able to conjure up an antidote, if you will, for a lot of this dysfunctional behavior. Of course, wherever we had our successes, there was a fair amount of willingness to change.
Yes.
And a lot of that willingness, you know, is person-dependent, but it also can be in the way you present, options and alternatives to dysfunctional managerial behavior. The right tone and the right approach makes people more receptive to change, and we saw some really positive results by taking the approaches that we're recommending in our case studies.
Fantastic. The title of the book, again, is Management, Diseases, and Disorders. 56 diseases and disorders are outlined in the book, 250 pages or so. And the authors Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes have indicated and certainly displayed the fact that there is some fun in this book as well. It's not just tough reading. It is a leadership style book, but employees can benefit from it as well. Sirs, where do I get copies of Management, Diseases, and Disorders?
It's available at really any outlet. Lulu Publishing was our publisher, so that's the first selection, but it's also on Amazon. It's also on Barnes & Noble. And if you go on the website, you can find other locations for it.
I have the impression that you might have had some fun doing this book, even though it was a year of your time. Is there a follow-up to this one?
Yes, about three or four.
Yeah, we're trying to narrow down what we think we could do. We got a really great book review from Blue Ink Review. We got it last night. And, in fact, the fellow gave us a great thing, saying it's an excellent book, well-written, insightful, clear, and concise. But he also said, hey, if you could go into more detail on the
treatments.
Yeah, that would be your second book. So he's already given us an idea.
Fabulous.
Where to go.
I'll tell you, we back to the first question you asked about, you know, what got us motivated to write the book. Again, I'll kind of summarize it just to give people, Steve and I have 70 years of experience in management, and we kind of thought, well, let's write a book that someone can skim and, you know, through in 70 minutes so that we can say, we'll give you 70 years of experience in 70 minutes.
Wonderful.
And you fast forward you, so you don't have to spend your whole career trying to learn this. You can be turbocharged to where we are in a matter of just, you know, a few months of application.
Yeah, this has been, it was fun, but it was also a pretty cathartic experience because you're sort of purging 70 years of experience out there. And while there's been a lot of fun in the process, there's a lot of very, very tough issues. In the public sector, especially at the county level, we deliver every kind of service that people need. And we have police officers, we have courts, we have healthcare, social services, parks, recreation.
Airports,
harbors, and so you get a diverse set of real life issues that happen, and as you know, it's there's no shortage of what people can do in the workplace, good or bad.
Absolutely,
we used to say that best antidote to a dysfunctional situation is a good sense of humor. But I will say, in addition to that, we think this book is a great antidote. We're very positive. We worked through some of the most demanding and almost scary type of situations to happy resolutions. So we really want to empower people to not be intimidated by the dysfunctionality in their organization or in their boss, because it's something that can be addressed and remedied.
Great. And one of the great commendations about this book is that both of you have worked on this for a year and are still talking. So that's probably worth the read by itself. You also have a website, I believe. Is it managementdiseasesanddisorders.com? Is that also your website?
Yes, sir, it is.
It's all one stream. No spaces, just managementdiseasesanddisorders.com.
Fantastic. Again, the title of the book, Management, Diseases, and Disorders, 56 diseases and disorders that are outlined in this book in a kind of a medical dictionary sort of approach. The writers, the authors, Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes, have joined me from California near Anaheim. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
Best of fun.
Best of luck for Indie Book Publishing Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. A Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing Westville Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is entitled Eternal Harmony, Volume 1, The Unity of Truth in God. And joining me from Arizona, his home base, is author Dr. Ron R. Rickards. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. In just looking over your book, a couple of things struck me. First of all, it's a complex subject. You are a doctor. What is your doctorate in?
My doctorate is in physics.
In physics, and you've approached the subject matter with that same scientific analytical mind that has made you a success in the industry of computers and science. You've taken that fascination with science and detail and all of those elements and incorporated them into your study, especially since you became what is traditionally described as a born-again Christian.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was born, actually, into a secular world. All my environment was secular. You could kind of say it's a long and winding secular road to Christ for me. So it's a secular world. My family was secular. Education was secular. And I pretty much was indoctrinated with all the secular things they talk about, science, that are very anti-theological. And I didn't know I was being indoctrinated, but I was. And the first time that I realized that I was is when I went to graduate school. And in graduate school, my best friend, it was a man by the name of Eric Harwood, who's a mathematician. He was studying to be a mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found in Eric is that here's someone who's every bit as logical as I am, every bit as reasonable, and yet there he is. He's a Christian, and not a shallow Christian, a very deep Christian. He studied Christianity like he studied mathematics. And he didn't seem to have any issue with it. So that kind of put the seed in my mind saying, well, maybe there's something here, that these things can be harmonized, and the things that I was taught growing up are not true. That put the seed in my mind where I'd have to look at it myself and not just rely on what I heard about the Bible. Obviously, I was learning quite a bit about science. The history of science, however, was kind of scarce. And what I found out later is that it's also twisted to be anti-theistic. C.S. Lewis has a brilliant quote. It's from his essay, Is Theology Poetry? And he said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So when I became a Christian, everything changed in a way. I could look back at these things and basically see through the secular lies and deceptions and the things that were turning me away from God. And another brilliant quote that I'd like to mention is it's attributed to Blaise Pascal. And he says, there's a God-shaped void in the human heart that only God can fill. And biblically speaking, it's only befitting that a creature made in the image of God should seek after the God of the image. That's basically another way of saying the same thing. But the problem is when you're growing up in a secular world, you don't know how to fill that God-shaped void because the secular world is giving you power, money, sex, all this kind of other things. And people, I think, in this day and age are seeking to fill that God-shaped void that way, and they're finding that it's leaving them empty. And the sad thing that I see is that our children should be taught that there's the God-shaped void that only God can fill. And therefore, when they feel that, they can seek in the right place. And then all the other things, you know, the education and so forth can fall into place as well. So that's where I came to, is the point when I became Christian. It changed everything. And then I was confronted with the problem, do I use my knowledge of physics just to make faster and better computer chips for the rest of my life? mm-hmm. which I was doing very well doing that. Of course, that makes a lot of money doing that. Or do I use physics to glorify God, having seen in this light that changed everything, having known what the lies and deceptions are? Do I just stay quiet, or do I produce a light in the darkness? And I chose to produce a light in the darkness, and that was a very, very difficult decision with a lot of thought and prayer, and my wife made that decision with me. And so these last 8 years, I've been working on this Eternal Harmony series of books, and this flagship book is Eternal Harmony, Volume 1, The Unity of Truth in God. And it's a very thoroughgoing book. It's very high-level physics, very high-level theology, and it's harmonized.
It's phenomenal. In addition to that, another interesting part of your story is the story of your spouse. Tell a little about her background and how she came to the United States.
Yes, yes. It's very interesting that even when I wasn't Christian, I had an affinity for Christians. And maybe it's because the Christ acting through them. So my friend Eric, I had an affinity for him because he was, you know, lived in a very Christ-like manner. And my wife was Christian and is Christian when I married her. So, and her family has a very interesting story because she was born in Tehran, Iran. And they actually left there because the Christians were being persecuted.
Hmm.
So they specifically left Iran under Christian persecution and came to the United States, unfortunately for me, because then I could meet her.
You have been married a number of years. Dr. Rickards, where do you begin to write a book like this? 656 pages just in Volume 1, and you have at least four volumes on the agenda. That must have taken a lot of time and diligence to get that accomplished. How long did it take? Was it more than 4 years, or how would you describe that process?
Yes, this has been 8 years in the working, and it's an interesting process because I didn't originally intend it to be that long, but I came to every day once I relinquished my job in 2009 to pursue this full-time.
Mm.
I came to my desk saying, "Here I am, Lord, what would you do through me?" And so it grew and it grew and it grew. And at this point, I actually have 3.5 volumes of the series written, but it's only now that the first volume is ready to go. And part of the reason is that I'm a musician, and so I like to describe it this way, is that people may not appreciate this if they're not musicians, but when you listen to a song, you hear the introduction, verse, chorus, and there's a structure to it. And quite often, as a composer, you actually write the verse and the chorus before you write the introduction.
Wow.
And so the verse and the chorus, you take those elements, you take motifs from them, and you incorporate it into an introduction. So quite often, the introduction is the last thing to be written. And that's kind of the case here, is that these four volumes form a unified whole. But I had to be close to the end of the series, basically, before I could write that introduction. And in a way, that introduction is actually half of this book. And so this book gives a very, very good overview of the whole series, and it will be developed in detail in the other volumes. So it had to play itself out and then come back, and now this is done. So, it's 8 years for the four volumes at work, but I had to endure that amount of time, really, with one income, and to finish this.
Now, are the volumes, the next in the series, are they as extensively researched and as long as your first book?
They are as extensively researched. They may be a little bit shorter, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've incorporated music. You mentioned that you're a musician. Is also a unique part of this endeavor. Eternal Harmony also has a music element. Share that with my listeners.
Yes, yes. This goes back to the commandments. When Jesus was asked which are the most important commandments, he said, "The most important one is this, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. Second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than this." So I view this book, the Holy Bible, is God's love letter to humanity and me. And this book, Eternal Harmony, is my love letter to God and humanity. And God is telling us to love God and love others with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the music is very powerful because it communicates heart to heart and soul to soul. The book can be powerful as well, but there are very intellectual sections in the book. And when you combine the two, you have the combination of heart, soul, and mind, and I think that's very unique. One of the things that I experience when I read atheist books, which is drudgery to me, I have to read them, and I do, but it's drudgery to me because they have "you are nothing but" statements. You know, you are nothing but billiard balls in motion,
right?
Or your mind is nothing but a computer, and you, there's just one "you are nothing but" after the other. And when you read those things, I get weary because, like I said, now I see it through Christian eyes, and they are not treating their readers like their readers are fully human. We treat each other as fully human when we treat each other in heart, soul, mind, and strength. Quite often, the heart and soul is missing from these atheist books, and you're just left feeling empty after reading it and thinking, oh, man, I feel sorry for this person if they think that's it.
Right.
It really isn't.
You've taken a very complex subject and applied scientific analysis of how it actually makes sense to believe the Bible as the Word of God. That is a very difficult task for many. Was it complicated for you, or how did it fall in place?
It fell in place because once I became a Christian, my eyes were open. And at that point, I was very sophisticated already in the scientific field. I had a PhD, and I was working for several years. So in a sense, my worldly eyes were very fine-tuned. And when I became a Christian, I studied vigorously. You know, I know what it takes to acquire a PhD, and I basically did the same work with the Bible. And my spiritual eyes were open, and I just saw these things harmonizing left and right. And I saw that these lies and deceptions that are told and are still being told in the schools today are just not so. So we have to be very careful. You know, there's a truth war going on, and the truth war is not between science and religion, as the secular world teaches. It's actually between truth and falsehood, which is what the Bible has been teaching all along. So when we take something like science and religion, they're actually like two sides of the same coin. You know, I talk about the concept of duality quite a bit in the book. And so science and religion form a duality, basically. And just like a real coin, if you deface one side of the coin, you're devaluing it. So same thing happens with science and religion. If you deface the science part, you're devaluating truth. If you deface the religion part, you're devaluating truth. So we have to be very careful, realize that the real war, the real battle is between truth and falsehood, and that there's true science and there's false science, and there's true religion and there's false religion. There's no effort here to try to harmonize truth with falsehood. It's harmonizing the truth of science with the truth of religion. And when you purify both fields like that, what you find is they're perfectly harmonized. It may be surprising that they're harmonized when you have this reductionist bottom-up view of things. But from the top-down view of things, which is basically what the Bible gives us, it gives us God's perspective on creation and us as creatures. From the top-down version, it's not surprising at all because God is the source. God is the creator. So the Word of God is consistent with the work of God, which is his creation, because they all come from God.
Because your book deals with such complex issues and certainly does a wonderful job of explaining them, 656 pages is a read that, who is going to benefit most from this? Is this for, do you think, students or for pastors? Who's going to be the ideal reader of your material?
Yes, students and pastors, but in general, genuine truth seekers, people who are willing to look at the truth of science and the truth of religion, and also the falsehoods of both fields there. So genuine truth seekers in particular, but especially the young, intelligent students in college, because this is, frankly, the book that I wish someone had given me.
Right.
If I could time travel, I would give it to myself before I entered college. Unfortunately, I can't do that, but I would. And so it's a perfect gift for parents to give to their children that are wandering off in the secular schools. And it's also good for the non-Christians because it gets you to question, you know, what are your truth values? And are you really rejecting religion on the basis of truth, or are you just doing it based on what you've been hearing? So if you really want to see, and you're non-Christian or non-religious, even atheist, science and religion can be harmonized, this is a book for you still. And, of course, it's a good book for pastors because I think this material, the harmonization of science and religion, is crucial to evangelizing in the 21st century.
Oh, yes.
You know, we have to admit, we have a society where kids are very adept with their computers and they have iPhones and we have laptops, we have desktops, we have a bunch of technological gadgets and gizmos. This is a very highly technological scientific age. So it's very critical in the task of evangelism to show that the Christian worldview is a very respectable worldview from a scientific perspective.
That's an important message you've just recapped right there. In fact, you have described this book as no real contradiction between God-made religion and genuine science. And your book is designed to show the vital fact beyond a shadow of a doubt that Christianity in particular stands in complete harmony with the best of modern science and even beyond that. Introducing this book to someone, what would be the way you would describe it if you were to get them interested in getting their own copy of Eternal Harmony?
This book is the book that will show you that science and religion can be harmonized, and exactly how and why they are. And the reason why they are is basically God loves us. He's the source of the Word of God, which is the Holy Bible. He's the source of the work of God, which is creation. And God loves us, and He wants us to be engaged in His purpose and His truth, because God, as the Bible says, is the God of truth. And so this is very critical, that it's all about seeking the truth and finding the truth. And when you genuinely seek truth, the Bible says, seek and you shall find. You arrive at God.
Yes. You have 12 original songs with this book, not actually sold with the book, but that are created to enhance the experience of reading Eternal Harmony, Volume 1. That makes this unique. Would you describe that as the most unique part of this book?
Yes, that is very unique, especially to this genre. And it's all in the effort to reach the reader in heart, soul, mind, and strength, all of these things. It's also, at a different level, expresses my love for God, because God has given me we all have very special gifts that God has given. They can be very unique. But the gifts God have given me are physics and music. And so this book is my giving those gifts, which are God-given gifts, back to God. And I think this is critical, too. It's like an electric circuit. You know, we're all familiar with flipping our light switches, correct?
Yes.
And when the light switch is off, you don't get the light coming from the light bulb. But when it's on, what you're doing is you're actually closing the circuit and you're causing a closed loop and you're allowing the electrons to flow. It's kind of the same. God is love. So God loves all of us. And that's true no matter who you are. But to get the light to shine, in a sense, you have to close the switch. And the closing of the switch is faith. It's not work. It's faith. But once that switch is closed, then the circuit flows and you get light, that you can shine your light into the world, as God says. So this is very important. I think it's true for everyone. You know, what is your God-given gift? Jay, you have a beautiful voice. And when you use your voice for radio interviews, you're using that God-given voice in context of like this interview to glorify God. This is what we're supposed to be doing. I'm doing the same thing, and it's with physics and music. And I would like to challenge the readers and listeners here. What are your God-given gifts, and how are you working towards giving it back to God, closing that circuit so that light can shine into the world? Because it's very, very important. That's what God wants us to do.
Congratulations on completing this, the first in the series. The title again is Eternal Harmony, Volume 1, The Unity of Truth in God. And my guest has been Dr. Ron R. Rickards. Thank you, sir, for joining me today. Where do my listeners get a copy of your book?
Thank you so much, Jay. You can get it pretty much anywhere, through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the publisher, Westbow Press. And I do have a website. It's ronrickards.com. That's ronrickards.com. And that's linked to actually the website of the ministry. The ministry is called Eternal Harmony Music and Literature. If you Google it, I'm sure you'll find it. And website is eternalharmonymusic.com.
Fabulous. Well, it's been a joy visiting with you. Congratulations on completing this very impressive project, and hopefully we'll get to visit on the next in the series as it's released. For my listeners, Rickards is spelled R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Rickards.
Thank you very much, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.